Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with My Opal, rewarding loyalty and taking care of members.
Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Holohan, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Philip. Nice to meet you.
Big picture stuff to begin, please. Where are we at? Where are we headed?
Well, things have slipped a little in recent weeks. Things have been improving in the early to mid-September. We've seen a significant increase in transmission over the course of the last fortnight, really. The average case number per day is about 1,900. We have in excess of 500 cases now per 100,000 of the population. And we see the incidence rising in all of the age groups and it's arising in all settings. And it's affecting all parts of the country, perhaps at different rates in different places. And that tells us that we've seen a significant change in our collective behaviour over the course of recent weeks. And they're going to have to focus on to try and turn that back down to a reducing level of transmission. Because one of the effects that we all know this is having is it's putting simply far too many people than we can sustain in hospital. We have an additional 14 people in hospital, in ICU, I should say, in the last 24 hours. The number of people in ICU now stands in the mid-80s. We have almost 500 people in hospital generally.
I heard a consultant on Morning Ireland saying it feels like January and it's only October. Yeah, is that a better way of expressing it?
Yeah, that is a good way of expressing it. It must feel like that. I heard a GP myself from Tramore, Dr. Dermot Nolan, yesterday putting it very well and describing the increase in pressure for general practitioners that they must be feeling all around the country and the experience that they're having that this is coming from all parts of their local communities. The reality is, as we find ourselves, we've had really good success in this country in terms of our vaccination programme. We've had in excess of 90% of people in the target population over 16 who've taken up the vaccine. But with these levels of infection, we know, and our advice from the ECDC is that vaccination alone is not sufficient to hold this. But this is a virus that, if it was left alone, would have a reproduction number of somewhere between 6 and 8, we think. And the level of suppression that we're achieving with our vaccination and with the measures at the moment is somewhere in the region of a reproductive number that's 1 point something. So even as things stand, we are achieving significant suppression of the virus, but it's just not enough at the moment.
Do you agree with that ECDC assertion that vaccination alone is not enough? Because it feels at this point, with the unwinding of restrictions and controls, that we have arrived at a point where we are effectively only fighting the virus with one tool. Vaccines?
Well, I do agree with that assessment. And the vaccination is very effective. It's particularly effective at helping people who pick up this infection from developing the severe effects of that and protecting a lot of people. And we know we've prevented a lot of deaths. We've prevented a lot of hospitalizations as a consequence of the vaccination.
But we have a lot of other tools that we're not using and people are now dying.
And you're exactly right. And we need to get those tools back out. And these are tools we know have worked in the past. So the public health behaviours, the basic things that people must be sick of hearing us talk about, hand washing, wearing of masks in certain situations, recognising the risk factors, particularly indoors, of crowding and meeting up with other people closely, the importance of things like ventilation and the importance of, in as much as we can, keeping our activities outdoor, and the really essential importance of, if one has any symptoms, cold-like symptoms, to stay away from meeting up with other people, from work, from school, from social situations. If we can collectively and it might only take a small improvement in our collective behaviour around these things, because things haven't gone drastically worse in terms of our behaviour, but a very small shift in our collective adherence to this basic public health advice is what explains what we're seeing.
And let's talk about one of the tools that's not working like it should do, even though it is still in place. You said yesterday at your briefing that we all know it would be easy to evade the COVID cert controls if someone puts their mind to it. Does that make an argument for forcing premises to ask people to present both the COVID cert and ID so that we know that, for instance, I can't turn up at a nightclub tonight using your COVID cert?
Yeah, look, anything we can do to try and improve the level of compliance and adherence to what we want to see happening, which is that we limit these what we would call higher risk environments, like a nightclub environment, a pub environment, they are higher risk environments. We limit those high risk environments to people who themselves are at lower risks from the severe effect of this
disease.
So
when you say anything we can do, you would be in favour of asking people to present both the COVID digital
passport? Yes, absolutely.
And
I think that, in fact,
and ID.
Yeah, and that in fact is the intention of the guidance, that people are supposed to demonstrate their COVID pass and also show that it's
there. It's not mandatory at the moment.
It's not mandatory, but that's what the guidance is. So in effect, what we'd like to see people doing is showing their COVID pass exactly as you're saying, and then also verifying that it's themselves. And some premises do in fact check that, and I've experienced that myself.
And in the absence of that guidance becoming mandatory, would you encourage people to walk out of a premises that doesn't ask for both COVID cert and ID?
I think it's going to be every little thing that we can do, and I think exactly as you're suggesting, that if you as an individual are out and about, you go into a pub or a restaurant for a meal or for drink or whatever, you're not asked for your COVID pass, or there are other things that you can see that tell you that the kind of guidance that should be in place is not in place. That's not a safe environment. And as I was saying at the briefing yesterday, like, we Irish people are not great at complaining sometimes when in restaurants, and that can be difficult for people. You can ask why you haven't been shown the COVID pass, but what really you should do is maybe not go back to that premises, because that's not a safe environment. That's considering, if you like, your health, your safety, and the safety of their staff in the first instance.
The other thing that we don't seem to be doing properly in an awful lot of places is asking people for their phone numbers when they present their COVID digital pass as well. I presume you would reiterate the same advice.
Absolutely. And again, my own personal experiences in that has been variable. So in some situations we've been asked for ID and telephone numbers, as we should be. In other situations, not. Yeah. So
and what happened to you in Dublin Airport?
Pardon me?
What happened to you in Dublin Airport?
Well, nothing. I came through Dublin Airport and I wasn't asked to show any evidence. And I'm not.
Were you surprised?
I'm not criticising. Well, that wasn't my experience when I was. I had travelled out of the country and I arrived in another airport and I was asked for all. And I wasn't allowed out, if you like.
Were you mixing with passengers of other planes, or is it possible that they knew that everybody on your flight had already been checked at the other end?
Well, at certain points before I got out the front door, of course, I was mixing with people from other flights, because that's the nature of
Dublin Airport,
of how it works. And so that's not to be a criticism, but just a mark that we all need to do more to try to ensure that these measures are fully adhered to.
Hopefully, very straightforward question, straightforward answer, if you can.
Sure.
Is there going to be an increase in case numbers as a result of the reopening that we're going to see tonight?
Well, certainly it's going to give us all the opportunity for more social contact. And the message that we have is to try to ensure, as like now society is going to be open, almost anything you wish to do is going to be possible. It's really important that you're mindful of your own personal behaviour and how that protects you as an individual from picking up this infection, particularly if you're somebody who's not vaccinated. And then also mindful of the behaviour that your behaviour will put other people at risk. So if you're symptomatic, you shouldn't be going out to a nightclub, you should be staying at home, you should be getting a PCR test. That's still our basic public health advice. Really important for people who've got symptoms, that their behaviour is good in the first instance. And all the basic messages around vaccination, although we've achieved a really high uptake rate of in excess of 90% of the target population, that still means we've got in excess of 350,000 people that we want to vaccinate, and we haven't vaccinated because they haven't come
forward.
This
does represent, though, a change in your position, maybe a tweak rather than a change, because you were the person who advised us, reiterated again and again and again, the virus loves alcohol, people drop their guard. Why is that different now?
Well, it's not that it's different, but like, we now have a very substantial level of protection in the population in terms of vaccination. Much of society is open. It doesn't mean that simply because every opportunity for us to engage in social activity is there, that we need to be all engaging in all of these things at the same time, or doing it in a way that isn't mindful of the kinds of risks that exist. It is possible, we think, for people who are vaccinated, for people who are adhering to all of the public health guidances in environments that themselves adhere to the public health guidances, for us to have safe experiences that limit and control transmission of this disease. And that's what society will be like as we move forward and we deal with the fact that COVID as a disease is something that isn't going to be eliminated. It is going to be endemic. It is going to cause challenges for us in terms of surges of infection from time to time that are going to have to be responded to, in particular by having strong and effective public health services that pick up these surges of infection when they occur and enable us to deal with them before they become a significant challenge. That's what life, in a sense, is going to be like as we deal with COVID as an endemic disease into the future, along with all the other respiratory and other viral infections we have to deal with.
The Taoiseach said 4 days ago that he was not going to be reintroducing restrictions. We were not going to be returning to lockdown. How close in formulating your advice did you come to putting the car into reverse?
I would say not that close, to be honest. I think that nobody wants to find ourselves going back the road of having to depend on what we know are crude measures designed to force us all to socialise less, to take the discretion and the decision away from us as individuals about what it is we may do. We now have a substantial portion of the population vaccinated. Those people in the vulnerable groups in particular for the severe effects of the disease, we know are well protected against those severe effects of the disease. And at these levels of transmission, the risk that arises to those individuals is much less, but it's still a substantial risk that we have to be aware of. And we need to now continue to try and do everything we can to try and reduce those levels of transmission. Okay.
So if the car wasn't going to go into reverse, how close would you have come to say, no, the car should be parked and stay exactly where it is and not move forward?
I think quite honestly, Philip, again, we felt that wouldn't be an honest assessment, because if, for example, we were to say, let's not consider the opening of nightclubs and review the situation in 3 or 4 weeks, hand on heart, I don't think the situation would have been any different in 3 or 4 weeks' time in terms of the decision around something like that. We would, in effect, have been saying to those sectors, you need to remain closed until probably the far side of the winter or some indefinite period of time. What actually was important, we thought, was to find a way in which we have managed to do for bars, for hospitality in general, for schools, for third level, and many other sectors that are now open, to do that in a way where sectoral guidance is applied that's designed to make customers and staff and users safe. Individuals' behaviour is then informed by appropriate risk tech, and the combination of those two things make the experience of all of us, you know, going back to school and or to college or socialising as safe as it possibly can be.
And in the real world, do you think that there is actually any pragmatic guidance that can be issued for the insides of nightclubs?
Well, I know work is being done on that, and I think there will be some pragmatic guidance developed along those lines. There are examples of it in other European countries, and doubtless those are informing the guidance that.
Because I mean, at the moment, what we're talking about, you know, wearing a mask in certain parts of the club and then taking it off when you go onto the dance floor, it all sounds a little bit amateur hour.
Well, I wouldn't say amateur hour. It all sounds a little bit strange. I would certainly say that, because that's not the experience of a nightclub that either we're all familiar with or the one that we necessarily want to have. The reality is, at a case level that we're dealing with at the moment, we simply have, like, the virus needs just the opportunity of people meeting up closely to transmit. And we're meeting up just a little too closely, all of us collectively, and giving the virus too many opportunities to transmit, and that's why we're experiencing the surge of infection. It's no more complicated than that. What we all then collectively need to do is to focus on trying to limit in as much as we can the risky forms of behaviour in terms of transmission, as opposed to eliminating them completely. Having a good understanding of the kind of risk profile of our own individual behaviour and activity, particularly for people who are not vaccinated, and then trying to ensure that we stay as safe as possible. Okay. And that's a particular message for people who are vulnerable. So we're not advising people to stay at home as we did previous times in the pandemic. But if you're a vulnerable person, to be aware of, look, the kinds of risks for me as an individual who's either over the age of 60 or an individual who's got underlying medical conditions, for example, to be aware of, look, the risks that attach to meeting up indoors and to being in indoor environments that are crowded, the importance of wearing a mask, the importance of limiting those social contacts, particularly with people outside of your own household, or people you don't know to be vaccinated.
And with all of that borne in mind, what kind of a Christmas do you think that we can afford to start planning for?
Well, I think that we'll have to keep these very basic commitments, as I've said, and an improved effort across the whole of society in terms of compliance with these basic public messages, and remind people of the importance of continually assessing our individual.
And to translate that into real terms, I mean, can I have mums and dads and aunts and uncles and cousins all around for Christmas lunch and in the house at the same time or not?
Well, I mean, like, all of those things may be possible, but like, we as individuals need to think about what risks attach to those for us as individuals. So for me, am I vaccinated? What are my underlying conditions? Do I have vulnerable people in my household? So all of these things will bear on the decisions that people will need to make around there. So they will be able to avail of these kinds of opportunities, as they will be able to avail of social opportunities outside of the household. So we're not going to
not invite an unvaccinated member of your extended family around for Christmas?
I think that an unvaccinated person at this point in time does pose an increased risk of both both picking up this disease and transmitting this disease to other people. And our message to unvaccinated people has got to be that the opportunity is still there for you to come forward. There's still vaccine. There's still a capacity to give that vaccine to individuals. It's really important to protect yourself and to protect those people that you love, that you live with, those people that you work with or interact with generally.
Okay. Just don't expect to be eating Tony's ham on the 25th of December. This brings me on to a really interesting and I hope not rabbit hole of a question. Waterford, official figures there say 99.7% of adults have been fully vaccinated, but it also has one of the highest COVID incidence rates of anywhere in the country. Do you understand what's going on?
Well, they've done really well in Waterford in terms of vaccination uptake. I mean, those are really, really impressive. There can't be anywhere else in the world.
But there isn't a dividend.
There is a dividend because people in that country are protected, or in that part of the country, just as other people who are vaccinated elsewhere are protected significantly, we know, from the severe effects of the disease.
Ignore my supplementary question. Let's go back to the first one. What's happening?
Well, the reality is that, look, the vaccines, they do not eliminate transmission of the disease. It is still possible for a vaccinated person to transmit this disease and to pick this disease up, even if they're protected from developing infection, even if they're protected from developing severe infection as a result of
I understand that, but how on a very basic level? More vaccinations should lead to more protection, no?
Absolutely. But when you think about that at the aggregate, what that really means is, particularly when we have high levels of infection in the country, we need more than just the vaccine. I said yesterday there's no single silver bullet. The vaccine itself is not a single silver bullet. There's no one thing that we can do that means we don't have to do everything else. So we need to put all of the things together, and suppression of this transmission that we're seeing at the moment, which we need to achieve, is going to depend on us having high levels of vaccination, and Waterford is a standard bearer for the rest of the country. Having these high levels of vaccination on its own is not enough, and we need to maintain our compliance with adherence to the basic public health measures. We need our sectors, our bars, our schools, our restaurants, our pubs, and whatever other sectors you care to mention, to do everything that they have to do to try to make the environment that they provide for us as safe as possible. And the collective effect of all of that is what we need to see.
Sticking with vaccinations for a moment, if we can, please.
Sure.
13 new hospital outbreaks reported last week, 11 in nursing homes. Why are we not yet considering boosters for healthcare workers?
Well, boosters are now recommended for people over the age of 60. They've already been in place and have been delivered to a lot of people in nursing homes over the age of 65, because that was previously recommended, as well as people over 80 in the community. Because we know that the risk of waning immunity in relation to those age groups suggests that we need to be boosting those, and that's why that's happening.
Fair enough, but we know
that.
My question is about healthcare workers.
We don't have that evidence for younger people, including healthcare workers. But that advice and guidance, which is prepared by NIAC, it's conveyed to me in the first instance. In the most recent conveyance of that advice, they said that the question of healthcare workers would be kept under continuing review, and they would make further guidance and advice available on that in the near term.
So while it might not do any harm giving them a booster, we don't know that it would do any good.
As ever with the vaccination, we have to be satisfied in the collective that the balance of good and harm is in the positive, that we do more good than harm. We don't have evidence of that as yet from NIAC and from their ongoing assessment of evidence in relation to healthcare workers.
On a population-wide level then, beyond healthcare workers, should we be assuming that the under-40s are not going to be getting booster vaccines anytime soon?
I think that's a fair assumption. And it doesn't look like that. Like certainly widespread population-based boosting of the population is likely to be something that we'd be recommending in the near future based on current evidence, because we see a fairly persistent good quality protection for people who are younger in terms of their immunity, and in particular their protection against the severe effects of the disease, which is good news in terms of the performance of the vaccines.
Antigen tests.
Yes.
Have you changed your mind on them?
No.
You didn't like them before.
No, it's not antigen tests. It's not the test, but the way in which it's applied and the circumstances in which it's applied. And there's a lot of confusion about them. So we've recommended that antigen tests now be used in a situation where you're a close contact, you're not vaccinated, and you don't have symptoms. And the HSC will make arrangements to give you a number of antigen tests to be done over a period of time.
If that advice is good for now, why wasn't it good for 6 months ago?
Well, that was the advice 6 months ago. We would use antigen tests in a situation where the likelihood of a person having the disease was high. And in the circumstance I've just described, the pre-test probability, in other words, the likelihood of you as a close contact who's not vaccinated of having the disease as a household contact, for example, is over 20%. So in that situation, they're recommended. What we recommended
against... But we weren't really doing that. We were sending people for PCR tests.
Because we had sufficient capacity. And at the moment, we have huge capacity now being given to PCR testing, 150,000 tests a week in PCR terms being done, which is huge, to supplement that capacity and to provide for a testing capacity for close contacts. Because of the rise in transmission we've seen, we're adding now antigen testing to that specific group. It's a very defined group. It's not general use.
All right. So, are you confident that we didn't miss a trick because of your advice on antigen testing, where they appear to have worked? They appear to have had beneficial results or impact in other countries.
I am confident about that. And the picture in international countries is mixed. I mean, our nearest neighbours, the UK, are probably the most prolific users of antigen tests and have the greatest challenge in terms of infection that really the Western world has seen.
It's complex, but I mean, I could quote you Sweden, but by way of contrast.
Of course, but like, I mean, there are multiple factors that go into determining what is the experience of a country in terms of incidence of the disease. It's not just, as I said, no more than anything else, one single issue is either not the cause of what's happening, nor is it the potential solution. And what we always advised against, and still do, is a widespread testing of people in the general population who don't have symptoms. Because the danger then is that if an individual gets a negative test and then undertakes something that they wouldn't have otherwise undertaken. But we have asked the rapid testing group, which is chaired by Professor Mary Horgan, to look at a very specific situation, which is the potential use of tests by individuals who might propose to undertake riskier, as it were, activity now that everything is open.
Okay.
Our concern was that, like, its use as a green light test, and I'm sure you've heard about the red light and green light use of that test, as a green light test to make something safe that otherwise wouldn't be safe. That's what we always advised against and still do.
And not to put too fine a point on it, do you still have concerns about people administering them to themselves properly, shoving that swab far enough up their nose and inflicting enough pain on themselves?
Yeah, so if they're to be used, we know that, like, healthcare professionals who are trained in the use of these tests will do the test to a higher standard than individuals. And that obviously is a concern that feeds into their general use.
And if it's not hurting, you're not doing it right.
Well, we know any of us who's had any form of test like this, it does hurt. You have to get a good sample. But we have increasingly new technology and new tests looking at simpler and easier and more accessible samples for the purpose of testing. But the basic advice has still got to be, if I may, on the subject of antigen testing, one practice that has come to our attention is people are using antigen tests when either they or their children are symptomatic to determine whether or not they have COVID. And then on the assumption of a negative test, meaning that they don't have COVID, sending children into school or continuing to engage in. And that is a really concerning practice, because what we're doing then is we're potentially missing COVID, but we're also missing RSV, which is now already a significant cause of problems in children in school, and potentially missing flu. And we're at the start of what might be the flu season. So that's a very concerning practice. So if individuals have symptoms, the advice is not an antigen test. Restrict your movements and get a PCR test.
You touched on it very briefly there earlier on. I want to go into it in a little bit more detail, if I could, please.
Sure.
The evidence of vaccine waning and its efficacy in the population. What is the latest research?
In so far as there's a concern in relation to the waning of immunity, and we haven't seen much evidence of that affecting our population here, it'll be in people whose immune response, older people who are not able to mount as good an immune response to infection.
And then when you see this new Delta subvariant AY42, how concerned are you about that? Is it a vaccine beater?
No evidence of that at this point in time, Philip, and no clear evidence that has a transmission advantage over the Delta.
Oh, I understood it had a 15% higher rate of transmissibility.
This is what's being reported, but there isn't a conclusion on that. That it's very clear to us that we're seeing transmission patterns that suggest that.
And do we have cases here?
And we've had a small number of cases here. And the important thing is we have a capacity to be able to, through the work of our National Virus Reference Laboratory, our whole genome sequencing, and all of those other capacities that are in place to identify these variants and to track them when the reports of those come out. So they're being tracked as quite a substantial number in the UK, but we've experienced numbers in this country. But it's not something about which we are raising alarm or concern at this point in time.
All the evidence is at the moment that the vaccine is holding the
yes,
line.
Yes, it is.
Okay. It was suggested that, what are we on now, the 21st of October, that NPHET would be wound up by this stage or at some point in October. It does look like you're going to be here for the foreseeable future, doesn't it?
Well, look, the nature of the disease is always going to determine what the quantum of advice is going to be. And the disease, unfortunately, doesn't always do what we want it to do. And certainly what we're experiencing in this country now is not what we necessarily all thought we might be. We hoped that by the end of this week, if we just take our nightclubs as an example, we could have been opening nightclubs without physical distancing, without the need for masks, without COVID passes and all of that. That's where we all wanted to be. That's where we all hoped we would be. And it's turned out that that's not, in fact, where we are. So we need a continuing focus on the advice and guidance that we need. And we need to keep our processes that provide for that in place until we have until we've gotten to the point that we're satisfied that we can move on. But like we would always have needed, so irrespective of what the process is going to be, my role, given the nature of it, was always going to mean that I would be in the fore of providing whatever guidance and advice was going to be needed on this disease or any other diseases.
So you as CMO, but that body of professionals, NPHET, that was going to be mothballed at least.
And I need that process to help me to give that advice. I need all those experts. I need all that expertise in terms of the different ologies, if I can call them that, across all the disciplines to help us to make balanced and fair assessments of what advice we should be giving to the minister. And that's why we need that process. And we'd all like a situation where we didn't need to have intense guidance and advice being provided around things like this or being provided around immunisation for a disease that has caused us so much challenge. But alas, the disease has in this country taken a turn that we didn't want it to take.
CMO Dr. Tony Holland, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed.